Kaya, welcome, hello everybody to another episode of the Curb Review podcast. My name is Andrew F. Pierce and I'm coming to you from Boolu, Western Australia, and I'm joined by Nadine Whitney, who is coming all the way from, where are you coming from, Nadine?
I'm coming from Naam in Victoria, which is, you know, not like on the other side of the planet, but it might as well be with our West Coast, East Coast rivalries.
Yes, and I mean, for a slight behind the scenes kind of navigation thing at the moment, you're currently doing daylight savings right now. I'm in the midst of scheduling a whole bunch of interviews for a few interviews for Sundance, but then a few other interviews as well for Australian filmmakers. And right now I'm currently trying to navigate. I'm trying to do a two-person interview. One person is based in Queensland. The other one is possibly going to be in South Australia. They might be in New South Wales, so I don't know at the moment. But it's this time zone stuff. It's chaotic, to say the least. It's not so much chaotic for us because we just jump on and talk whenever, but scheduling interviews, it is chaotic. So nonetheless, very boring kind of background stuff for people who are listening. But anyway, so we are going to be talking about a few films this week. We're going to be talking about Sing Sing. We're going to be talking about Magic Beach. And we're going to also be talking about another film, which I will not pronounce, but that will be a mystery later on when we get to it. But let's start talking about Sing Sing, which is a glorious film.
Sing Sing is really just about brotherhood more than anything. They said, we think we have a great co-star for you, Clarence Macklin. And I was like, I'd love to meet him. And immediately we connected so well. It was really beautiful and funny and organic. It felt like one of my brothers.
Working with Coleman Domingo was an absolute pleasure, man, and a delight. The brother's a ball of positive energy. He saw in me things that I didn't see in myself.
You did your thing, beloved.
It's directed by Greg Quitter. It's co-written by Greg Quitter and Clint Bentley. It stars Coleman Domingo and Clarence Macklin. And Clarence Macklin is really important for this particular film because it is effectively based on his life and what he has gone through, which is set in Sing Sing prison. And this is just a glorious film about the power of art and the power of bringing people together in difficult circumstances and times of need, when they have nothing else other than the room that they have to go to at the end of the day. And this is a powerful, powerful ode to art and the uniting force of theatre. It is such a beautiful, beautiful film. The plot really follows the narrative of Coleman Domingo's Divine G, who is also known by John Whitfield. He's somebody who has effectively been in Sing Sing for a period of time, has gone through this kind of annual theatre kid thing that goes on in Sing Sing on an annual basis. Nadine, you'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a moment. But he's gone through the motions of seeing people come and seeing people go. And again, Clarence Macklin, who plays effectively plays himself in the film, is the real version of Divine G, somebody who had gone through those kinds of things himself in the prison and nurturing and fostering this kind of prison program for the arts. Again, this is just a beautiful, beautiful film. Nadine, let you talk about it as well, and I'll respond to what you have to say, because I know that we've both resonated really strongly with this film, and it's kind of been a quiet presence in the awards campaign, and I kind of wish that it was better treated by A24 in getting a theatrical release. And I know in Australia it's getting a theatrical release right now, and we'll be screening at Perth Festival very, very soon, but it should be everywhere. So tell me about why it should be everywhere.
It should be everywhere because it is about empathy. It's a film that is so strongly rooted in empathy and humanity. One of the characters says, we come here to become human again after the dehumanizing effects of being inside the prison complex in Sing Sing, which is a maximum security prison just outside of New York. I think that it is a crowning glory for everyone in it, but specifically Coleman Domingo, whose face, you know, just lights up, and every time he is acting, as Divine G, it's something that you can tell is essential to the core of his being. And I have rarely felt so strongly for a lead character that I just wanted everything to be okay for the beloved.
I find Coleman Domingo so fascinating as an actor as well. Like, I've appreciated his performances and growing over the years of getting to see what he's capable of doing on screen. And then kind of leading into what he does off screen as well, because I understand that he really fought for equal pay for everybody on this particular film. He made sure that everybody was supported and looked after in a way that feels kind of out of the norm for films made in America, independent or otherwise. And so this is, you know, as trite as it might sound, it is a very values-driven performance and a very values-driven film. There is something that is really about what he wants to put out into the world. And it's interesting listening to him talk with people. There's a really great, the whole Variety Actors on Actors interviews that goes on. He did one with Kieran Culkin. Their conversation is quite a beautiful one, but Coleman is very open about what he wants and how he sees the world and what the power of art, basically, of what it can do to people, bringing humanity. And we see that kind of most poignantly in a really early moment, I think, where Clarence and Divine G are talking with one another, and Divine G is trying to recruit people for the upcoming play, which is a very I guess the word I'm looking for is an amalgamation of different ideas. They script a play which has time travel and all this kind of stuff. The play itself doesn't really matter because it's about the performances that they get to bring. Nonetheless, Divine G is trying to recruit people to be actors in this play, and then Clarence appears and he has Shakespeare in his mind. He has literature in his mind. It's right there at the surface. He is just scooping it up and being able to recite it. And this is a film that talks about the access to those kinds of things, to literature, to culture and to the arts, and to be able to show the power of what it does. And that does seem like a very kind of, it is kind of an artsy-fartsy thing to be able to go, well, art is very powerful and it means everything. But in a film like Sing Sing, it shows you how it does really mean everything. It gives people something to hold on to, and it quantifies the feelings that people might be feeling in this kind of situation, this darkness. I find it so powerful and so moving, and just, you can tell how moving it is to all the actors as well. And a lot of them are prisoners themselves too. So there is this dual meaning sense of not only getting to act in a film with an Oscar nominee, but also getting to be in something that speaks exactly to what the text is about. Do you want to add to that as well, about what that kind of means?
Well, the film itself later on near the end talks about the RTA program and asks people to donate to it if they can, because they're running on fumes inside Sing Sing to get these things done. I think that what the film does in terms of Divine G, Mike, and Divine I is to show that each of these people have lived a difficult life. You know, Mike, through trauma, got into taking drugs, and you see him dressed, I assume in kind of a Krishna style clothing, so he's obviously converted during his time in the prison, with Divine Eye, he's a career criminal, and he believes that his criminality is just being passed on generationally to his son, who is now in prison as well, and that maybe art is there, but it's pointless for him. He believes to begin with, it's pointless for him. You know, what does it actually do? What does it achieve? And Divine G just sits with him and says, it gives you a chance to be free beyond the borders of this place and to express your pain and to get support. And it's just so beautifully, beautifully filmed. And the performances, the play itself is hilarious. And it's a group effort. But when you see him doing Midsummer Night's Dream, which is the opening sequence, and it pulls close onto Divine G's face, you just know the power of theatre for him. And he's also a playwright, and that's what he's doing, you know, in his tiny, tiny, tiny cell that gets regularly turned over by guards, you know, and destroyed. So he has to remake and remake and remake. And this is what the prisoners themselves are doing. It's, you know, in the theater program, they're remaking themselves. They're fixing the damage that is consistently being forced upon them by the prison system and by their own outsiderness in society.
Mm. It's the, you talk about the visuals and, you know, the ability for it to kind of take them outside. And there is, the cinematographer is Patrick Scholar, and there are a fair few moments of people looking outside their windows and looking out to the outside world, which they can't really see. They can just see some grass and some trees and the barbed wire fences, but it's outside. It is still somewhere that isn't in there. And I think it's very easy for a film to tell you that these people want to be outside, that they want to be free. But what they do here collectively, everybody does here, is that whole guiding of going, let's make you feel like you also want to be outside with them. Like, let's make you feel like there is that hope of freedom. And I don't think I really get to see that sense of what freedom actually means on screen very often, but Sing Sing does a very, very masterful job of being able to present what that drive towards freedom actually feels like. And, you know, it comes down to the basic things of the look in people's eyes or being able to look out a window or just the performances. Again, I'm in awe of this film. I think that it is what the power of collaborative work can do, which is really quite something. And, you know, off mic, we talked about, like, the brilliance of Nickel Boys as well, which we'll talk about again in the future. But I think that Sing Sing and Nickel Boys are doing something that is almost a little bit radical about how films are treated in America nowadays, where they are so open with the human experience and so distinctly pushing away the feeling of being manufactured experiences. And, you know, that's what art should be, realistically. And it's interesting, I'll talk about the film that I will mention as a bonus film later on, is such a distinctly manufactured thing, but there is still that kind of hope and positivity in there. And yet Hollywood filmmaking has kind of shied away from that sense of why we even go to films in the first place. Why do we go to watch a movie in the first place? We want to feel something, right? And Sing Sing gives you all the feels. How many times have you watched it as well? Because I've watched it twice, and both times I was left a mess at the end.
Three times now, and each time I see something small and something new and something rich, because I've been trying to work out, because Divine G is actually a real person who appears in the film. later on as a character who walks in and gives a monologue. I've been trying to work out all those little bits in the film that are telling you this is a real experience. And, you know, it is Roger Ebert's quote in Praxis that cinema is an empathy machine. And I think it is one of the most beautiful and accomplished and human films I have seen in a long time. Colman Domingo is glorious. Clarence Macklin is amazing, absolutely amazing. And I can't fault it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't fault it either. I would comfortably give it a 5-star rating. I think that is one of the best films that we've seen in a very long time. I urge people to go and see it. Have that communal experience. Watch it with people. Lean into that kind of the emotionality of it. What about you? What would you rate it?
Oh, I rate it a 5-star film, not only because it is Colman Domingo's finest work, but also because it is a precious piece of empathy, kindness, understanding, and what it means to be free of the constraints of the boxes people put you in life.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. And it's amazing as well, because you're sitting here talking about it and it makes me just think about it all over again. And, you know, that's the power of great films. You don't need to have that experience of actually sitting there watching it. Once you've seen it, you should be able to, just like, you know, Clarence experiences in the film, like you're just scooping up Shakespeare from the top of your mind and it's right there. And that's what it's like for me, just being able to immerse myself or, you know, dip a toe into Sing Sing in my memories and you know, transport it back there. Ah, it's beautiful. All right. Let's shift on to the next film, which is collaborative production, I guess is the best way of putting it. And I'm not going to name all of the animators, but I will urge you to head on to thecurb.com.au to check it out. I'll stick a link in the show notes where I had a conversation with both Robert Connolly and Alison Lesser about their latest co-production or work together, which is Magic Beach.
At our Magic Beach, we swim in the sparkling sea. Surfing and splashing and jumping the waves, shrieking and laughing with glee.
Who's there?
Hello.
It's an adaptation of Alison Lester's children's book, which is all about, as the title suggests, a beach. It is beautifully, beautifully brought to life in a collaborative process of a whole bunch of different animators alongside some live action interstitial moments that connect them all together. There is not really a strong narrative that links it all together other than it's about kids going to the beach and experiencing the joys of the beach and getting to see what that's like. But it is, you know, something that effectively is really aimed for kids who are 8 years and under. And so that does kind of make it a little bit difficult to review in some sense, because I don't know if people know, but I am clearly not a child 8 years or under, but I once was a child 8 years slash under. You know, I'm able to kind of revisit what I had wanted or think about what I had wanted as a kid growing up in cinema. I don't know if Magic Beach is something that I would have resonated with. There is this sense of exploration, of imagination, of joy and all this kind of stuff that is quite clearly on screen in a lot of the different animated shorts, which kind of range from everything from a stop motion short with a battle on the beach to pirates to swing under the ocean with mermaids and stuff like that. There's a whole bunch of different things that kind of supposed to kind of spark the senses of enjoyment and stuff like that. Goes for about 70 something minutes as well, so it is a brief experience for kids, and I think it's also kind of crafted in the way that they can walk away from the screen and come back if they want to, that kind of stuff. But it's nice. What did you feel about it, Nadine?
Anthology films are often difficult to review because you'll find one or two sections that are absolutely sterling pieces of cinema, and then you'll find a few that drop the quality of the entire production down. And I think that with Magic Beach, the framing of it is great. So the framing is Alison Lester's book, and each child is having the book read to them at some point, or is reading the book and or remembering the book, and that's when they go into the imaginative state of them going to the beach, the magic beach. But I don't know if it would hold my attention as a child. I think some of the brighter sections would, but overall it becomes far too abstract to fully cohere. And I loved, for example, the felted stop motion animation. That was gorgeous. The polyclay stuff, you know, that's my jam. But the tale of not the pirates, but the man who lures people onto the shore with his lantern. That was great. That's classic kind of Australian storytelling, and it's beautifully done. But if you put all these things together, and if you're imagining that people 8 and under are watching it, I don't know how a 5-year-old is going to react. I'm going to guess that at some point they're going to be really, really bored. And that is unfortunate. As an adult, I adored certain sections of the film. I thought they were so well done. And you know, it reminded me, of course, of The Turning, which is Robert Connolly's anthology film based on Tim Winton's stories, you know, but the Turning had a much stronger connective tissue than I think this one does. I hesitate to be able to even give it a decent scoring because I don't know what it is like for the intended audience. All I can talk about is how I saw it and how I imagined somebody young seeing it and knowing the behavior of children in cinemas and, you know, what keeps them glued to a screen.
Yeah. Like, to me, I think that's a really important note. Like, I think of the average Bluey episode is like 5 minutes long. And to me, a film like Magic Beach feels like it would probably benefit more from being a, you know, spliced up kind of experience. It's great that it's a feature length film. But I think that if it has another life going on, which is interesting. When I interviewed both Robert and Alison, I didn't ask this, and I kind of wish that I did. But I'd be curious if the intention is down the line to have that kind of split up 5-minute segment to allow that dipping in and out, or the kind of episodic nature of it, because that's really what the film is. It's very episodic in nature. I agree that it's difficult to kind of rate a film like this. I enjoyed it. I appreciated it. I find it interesting that I think of Ian Darling's documentary The Pool quite a bit when I consider a film like Magic Beach, and they're very different. One is a documentary about a swimming pool. One is a, you know, a kid's fantasy fiction film about a beach. But the documentary makes, like, I didn't love it in the moment, but in retrospect, I've really appreciated it, and I've thought about it a lot over the months since I've seen it. I watch it again, and I find the experiential nature of that particular film quite beautiful. It washes over you, and I don't expect a film like Magic Beach to have that kind of experience, but such a visually driven film, you'd almost hope that it would be able to at least linger in your mind in some way. And yet, since I've watched it, it hasn't really lingered in my mind. I haven't had that kind of emotional connection. And I think that's the thing about why I wonder if I'd had watched this when I was like 7 or 8 years old, whether I would still have that emotional connection. The same kind of emotional connection that a lot of kids have with Alison Lester's actual book itself, which is a beautiful book. It's a wonderful experience. But I think that it's all about the delivery. And usually if a kid's having a book read to them, it's from a parent or from a loved one, right? And so there is that warmth there. And I'm not saying that this film doesn't have warmth, but it doesn't have the same kind of connection or that same kind of warmth that would make it linger in your mind. So again, it makes it hard to rate it, but it's lovely looking. And, you know, it's a really nice film. And I'm glad that Robert Connolly's doing this, you know, still doing like adult films as well as dealing with youth-focused films like Blueback and Paper Planes and now this, of course. So he is really pushing both angles of well, the whole spectrum of age. I didn't love it, but I appreciated it. I think that's probably the kindest thing I can say.
I grew up around the beach, so I have a granular kind of understanding of what a beach means in a child's imagination. It wasn't South Gippsland where the beach scenes are filmed, but Northern New South Wales and Sydney. So I know the dream states that being on a beach can inspire, and I did appreciate that about the film. I can remember being, you know, 7 years old and being in the nippers and running around and planting flags, and you know, I can remember the sense of getting into the water and feeling eternal, you know, and if you are lucky enough to ever swim in the ocean and just go beyond the tide, the breakers, you can just be floating in this sense of you are part of everything. And I think that the first film, the first short, gives you that with the riding of the white foam horses. I go back to things that resonated with me as a young person in Australian cinema, like playing Beatty Bo and Careful He Might Hear You. I can still recall those films. We Have the Never Never. I can still recall those films from my childhood. I don't know if I was a child now, I would be later on recalling The Magic Beach, but I do appreciate it exists. I don't dislike it at all. I'm just unsure whether it will work for the intended audience. So my overall review of it would be generally positive. I think that visually it is lovely. I think imagination is incredibly important to children. And I think that Robert Connolly is a generous filmmaker and collaborator. So that's my review in the end.
Do we want to give it a rating? I don't think it's fair to give it a rating for this one as well.
I would happily give it a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, I'd probably give it about the same, which again is not like a slight on the quality. I know that some people like 3 is a negative, like a less positive, but I think it's fine. Right, so moving on to the next film, the one that I'm not allowed to pronounce because I say it incorrectly, but it's a Paolo Sorrentino film.
Yeah, well, I think everyone's going to say it incorrectly because it's Italian and I'm not Italian, but I think it's Partenope or Partenope.
Are you aware of the disruption your beauty causes?
I'm starting to suspect something.
Anyone who's seen The Great Beauty will know that it's Sorrentino's sort of love letter to Rome and also a hate letter to Rome. Now, it's both of those things at once. You know, they're an older man is looking over his experiences in Rome, in Partenope or Parthenope. It's set in an earlier period. It starts in, I think, the 50s with the birth of Partenope, who is named after a siren who Naples is named after. And this woman, this child, grows into an absolutely stunning woman and becomes essentially the spirit of Naples. It's beautifully shot. In every way, it's an absolute dream, and all credit goes to the cinematographer.
I've got as Daria D'Antonio.
Yes, and she's worked with Sorrentino often. Credit also goes to the first time debut actress who plays Partenope. She is beautiful, and you can see why people think of her as a siren. The questionable thing is whether or not the way that men move towards her and treat her is something that Sorrentino should be vaguely celebrating. I think that at one point he does turn it on its head and say, you know, it gets disgusting. But it's the opulence of his work that fetishizes that kind of relationship that men have with women in all of his work, really, you know, all of it. It has moments that reminded me of Death in Venice, when Partenope comes out of the water and she moves her foot the same way that the young boy in Death in Venice does, you know, not realizing his beauty, and she is observed in the same way by her friend-lover who enters into, oh my goodness, a love triangle between her and her brother.
So a little bit of incest then.
Yes, just a implied incest, actual incest. I think it is actual in the film. It, you know, fall into me is something that is repeated often, you know, falling into this reverie. I do believe it is aesthetically stunning, and I can see why A24 picked it up on that basis. I also, again, wonder about Sorrentino's specific fetishism for what is beautiful as opposed to what that actually means in the end. And I think that she's called a failed siren because Partenope was a siren. And I'm not sure if her simply living, learning, being intelligent, kind and expressive makes her a failed siren. It means simply that whenever somebody is attracted to her, which is often not of her doing or sometimes is, everything falls back on it being her fault because sirens lure men. She is incredibly intelligent. She is, the character is a teacher, a student. She is often more intelligent than the people who are trying to mentor her. There's a great section with Gary Oldman playing John Cheever, and She meets him at a resort, and they discuss life, and he just says, you know, beauty is a curse. And she said, yeah, I'm beginning to realize that. So yes, it's basically the story of Naples, and Partenope is Naples itself. So beautiful, changeable, intelligent, sometimes criminal. Naples is a confusing place, and I think that the most people from the city would say so as well.
It sounds interesting. I do like his films, but I don't, like, whenever they come out, I tend to go, oh yeah, there's another one, right? And I don't tend to actively seek them out. But it sounds like, you know, at least on a visual level, it's something that I should probably try and see if possible. So I guess, yeah, closing thoughts on it. Is this something that we should be seeking out on a big screen?
Oh, definitely seek it out on a big screen, because the cinematography is absolutely worth it, and you will never see Naples look so clean ever again. It is, again, that love letter to his hometown is where Sorrentino comes from. And it is stunning to look at, and it has that mesmeric quality that a lot of his films do. You know, The Hand of God had that thump, thump, thump of the water going through it the whole way. The Great Beauty, well, everyone knows how beautiful that film is. Partenope is on that level of visual splendor. So I would say definitely seek it out on the big screen if you're going to see it. I think if you're a Sorrentino fan, it's an instant yes. You must go along. It is an auteurist driven work, and if you like him, you will love it. If you find him, you know, a little bit indulgent and sometimes a little bit blind to what he's putting forward, I'm not sure you'll thoroughly buy the film. But my overall rating of it would be kind of a 3.5 out of 5, one of Sorrentino's beautiful constructions of a beloved city in his life.
Well, it certainly looks interesting. Now, I'll let you continue talking about your recommendation of the week as well.
Hey, my recommendation of the week has a very tenuous relationship to the other films. Extremely tenuous. The only thing that I can say is that one of the characters is essentially imprisoned. And it is, whatever happened to Baby Jane? I was rewatching it recently for another project I'm working on, and I think it is a genius work by Aldrich. Nobody captures people driving the way that Aldrich captures people driving. If you watch a Robert Aldrich film and somebody's driving in it, he's just the man for driving. As I think everyone knows, it was the beginning of the hagsploitation genre, with a 54-year-old Betty Davis, 54, hardly a hag, playing Baby Jane Hudson, and her real-life rival, Joan Crawford, playing her sister Blanche Hudson, who live in this kind of gothic, decaying Hollywood, not mansion, at large house, at the height of Blanche's career, she is crippled in a car accident. Baby Jane Hudson in 1918 was the talk of vaudeville and pushed into the spotlight by her grasping father. And whilst he pushed Baby Jane into the spotlight, he ignored Blanche. and later the roles were reversed. And so you had these two sisters battling each other in some of the most abject and gross ways possible. I just find the work remarkable, watchable over and over and over again. And even in this rewatch, I noticed something I'd never noticed before, which is a Margaret Keane picture in the background of Mrs. Bates' house. And, you know, the big eyes, Margaret Keane, Tim Burton made a film about her. And at that stage, people would have assumed it had been painted by Walter Keane. Later on, Joan Crawford was one of the people who was painted by Keane with the big eyes. And in that scene is Davis's real-life daughter talking about how much she dislikes baby Jane Hudson and how they should probably kill her. There is this beautiful kind of intertextuality to it. And of course, I think too, the intertextuality of it is somehow based on Judy Garland as well, from the 1961 book, then to the 1962 book, the Minnesotan child put into vaudeville called Baby, which was what Ethel Gum was doing with her parent, and being pushed into showbiz, and then, you know, having, you know, quite a public emotional breakdown through at that point. And so, yeah, I think almost everyone I know has seen the film, but I can thoroughly recommend rewatching it because it is a masterpiece of horror, of Hollywood Gothic, of two great actors really fighting it out on screen and in person. And it is the best film of the hag-sploitation genre, in my opinion.
Well, I do need to rewatch it. It's been at least 30 years since I've seen it. So I was far too young to, it was one of those films that I think I watched because it was on a list, and as a growing cinephile, and I didn't really get it at the time because I hadn't watched enough of the older films. But so I do need to rewatch it, with having had the experience of growing older and getting to see a lot of the other work that these people have done, and Robert Aldrich has done as well. So it's on my list to revisit in the future, which I guess is, you know, one of the things which I know that a lot of people tend to do when they start off a year is try and tick off films that they should watch that they haven't watched, or tick off films that they need to rewatch, like Baby Jane, for example. And I jumped on that meme that everybody was doing, or the trend that everybody was doing at the start of the year, which was basically asking for 12 different films from 12 different people. I ended up with 21 films from 21 different people on my list. So I'm going to gradually work through that throughout the year. And the first film on the list is probably the film that I feel most... well, this and one other film on the list, which I haven't seen, which is Tokyo Tsuri. They're both of the films that I feel kind of most aggrieved that I hadn't seen them as of yet. But the first one is Superman, Richard Donner's Superman, which I had put off for so long for having seen it because of the fact that I find the character of Superman rather insipid at times. And it's often...
We're going to have a fight.
Well, it's only because of the certain depictions on screen, like Brandon Routh's Superman, for example, you know, or Dean Cain's example and things like that. And I find that I'm less intrigued by the character of Superman than I am with the character of Clark Kent. I find it really, really interesting to see what Clark Kent is like on screen. I much prefer the time that we get to spend with a Clark Kent than we do with Superman. And Christopher Reeve manages to do something which is really quite phenomenal in that he balances the two roles very, very well. And, you know, I'm kind of stunned that he didn't get any awards attention for this role. Granted, it was the 70s, so they were very much still into the whole kind of serious stuff, but he's so effortless here. And it's a beautiful, beautiful film, and it's full of hope and it's full of joy. And I'm surprised by how quiet it is at times and how it just lets the character's internal monologue talk and how it lets them think, and we don't actually need to hear what they're saying. There is one scene which I think is one of the best that I've seen in a superhero film ever, which is Margot Kidder's internal monologue, which we do actually get to hear, where she's asking, can you read my mind? And then her basically talking about what being with Superman means as they're flying in this beautiful, beautiful sequence, which is just still such a visually striking moment. It is quite emotional how joyous it actually is. But again, there is that whole internal, there are sequences that go for like 5 or 6 minutes where you don't hear any dialogue whatsoever. Fascinating. Like that feels like such a rarity in a blockbuster film. And obviously it's a scene setter for what superhero films could do, but it's really disappointing that all these people who talk about, we want to bring back the mood or the vibe of Superman, they don't think about that kind of stuff. They don't think about how internal it is. You don't have a hero who is just talking to themselves all the time. And I think that's really quite, it's highlighted quite well in the climax when Superman is trying to basically save the West Coast of America in this really quite exciting moment. And yet everything, he's not going, oh, I need to get here, I need to get there, I need to go and do this, I need to go and do that, which a lot of, like, I guess the kind of quippier Iron Man who has somebody to talk to all the time has kind of guided how superhero films are driven nowadays. There's always somebody for them to talk to. There's an Alfred for them to talk to. There's, you know, a machine for them to talk to. So they're always, always talking. And I think it's a hangover of the Joss Whedon effect in a way. And I really wish that they would kind of look at something like Superman, which is so internal, and you just get to understand the tension that is gradually ticking over in his mind, which is then so brilliantly presented when he reverses time to bring back Lois Lane, like to save her life. And the comedy of then having him gone through all that emotion and all of what he's done, and then she goes, what have you done? You dropped me out in the middle of nowhere. Like there is a comedic beat which just works. it's a joy of a film, and it's nice to be able to watch a film like this and then actually feel everything that you should be feeling and it not feel aged or, you know, weathered or anything like that. There is just this beautiful, timeless sense to this version of Superman. I understand it gets to be diminishing returns for the sequels. I'm not sure if I'm going to go down that path or not, but at least I've seen
this. Number two is good. Number two, which has Terrence Stamp playing Zod, is quite good. But by the time you reach number three, yeah, it's not, just don't do number three. There are two Christopher Reeve Superman films.
Of course there are, yes, yeah.
There are two. I saw it when it came out, because I am paleolithic. So I guess it was, other than the Batman television series, the first real superhero film I'd ever seen. And I can remember specific scenes from it even now, which, you know, like the Daily Planet scene where Donna just lets the camera wander through and capture people's conversations as it goes. It's in a lot of ways like the new cinema, the new American cinema that was being touted as the only thing happening in the 70s in America. He's doing that, but he's doing that in a superhero film. He's doing that kind of verite capturing of conversations. the score is in my head. You know, John Williams' score is dun, dun, dun. It's always there. And I think Margot Kidder was a fantastic Lois Lane. You know, she had that sort of fast-talking, hard journalist thing going on, but she also had, you know, doubts and sensitivities, worked with Clark himself, who, you know, is not a showy character in any way. And that's true to the comics too, that, you know, Clark isn't a showy character. Why I was going to say that we're going to have a fight about Superman is, for me, like, I'm always going to be a darker side of New York person, so it's going to be Gotham for me rather than
the bright lights of Metropolis.
Yes, exactly. But if you look at who created Superman and how they did it, it's two Jewish refugees creating the ultimate American hero, who comes from a place that was destroyed into a world where he has to assimilate but can't quite assimilate because he is different to everyone else, but uses what he learns about humanity for good.
Yeah, see, I love that aspect of him as a character. And, you know, if people want a great book, they should go and read Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which does talk about the history of comic books and does talk about the history of, in some capacity, minorly fictionalized version of the history of Superman as well. It's a great, great book. But what I rub off against is not the narrative version on the page of Superman, it's the presentation on screen. And I don't think that, you know, we've had decades and decades of people who have just misunderstood who he is as a character, and that's why I've really rubbed off on it. You know, and I found it, I was talking to Carly, my partner, last night as we watched it, and I said, you know, I did watch almost all of Smallville, and yet when I kind of tuned out of Smallville was when Superman as a character came around, because I didn't feel that really worked as a, like, the build-up as Clark Kent in that TV show didn't really feel like it was an organic step over to Superman as a character, unlike it is in the film here. I think it's really, really, you know, he's a lovely guy. He's an interesting character who's got a lot going on. But Hollywood is so often skewed towards the darkness of it, right? And that's why I'm kind of really excited about seeing what James Gunn does with the character, because he understands what the power of hope and positivity can do in a way that few filmmakers nowadays working on that scale are actually able to do. So I'm excited to see, you know, possibly a return to the vibe of it, of what, you know, Reeve and Donna managed to create here. I think it's, and Mario Puzo as well. I think it's really, yeah, it's quite something. But I'm glad to have finally seen it and kind of ticked it off and experienced the emotionality of it. I was just surprised by how moved I was by it and how enraptured by the joy of it I was as well. So it is really a delightful film. No doubt as we go along and as we continue doing these kinds of discussions throughout the year, I'll touch on the other films that I will be watching throughout the year, one of which you had recommended, which is Beach Rats. So that's on the list. But to give people just a very vague idea, I'll stick a link in the show notes. There's other films like Tokyo Story as well. I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, Merrily We Go to Hell, Punishment Park, and 20th Century as well. So there's a lot of different styles of films. They're not all going to be positive.
Is any one of those I haven't seen? Tokyo Story, I don't think you'll recover from.
And yeah, that's part of why I've kind of held off on it for so long.
choose a day when you're feeling quite buoyant.
Yeah, yeah.
20th Century by Rankin is so much fun to choose a day when you're feeling miserable and put that one on.
No worries. Well, that's good ideas. All right. Well, with that said, that's another discussion. another review discussion. So Sing Sing, again, is out in cinemas, I believe, right now, but it also is screening at Perth Festival at the end of January. And as well, Magic Beach will be landing in cinemas on the 16th. And the Sorrentino film is also in cinemas right now, too. So, yeah, thank you again, Nadine, for this lovely chat and discussion about films. I think in the future what we'll also probably do is I might do a shout out. If anybody has any questions, they can do so, but I won't do it right now. But just keep that in the back of your mind. If you're listening and you have any questions for us, next episode I'll tell you how you can reach out to us and let us know what you want to ask us and things like that. No pressure, of course. But you can find us on thecurb.com.au. You can follow us on social media. Blue Sky is where we're fairly active. What's your social media profile on Blue Sky? What's your handle there?
Just Nadine Whitney at, so my name, leave it very simple.
Very, very simple. Yes.
I thoroughly recommend to people who have just been burned by every other version of social media. And after what we're seeing with Meta, I can only strongly suggest that people move over to that platform whilst it's still somewhat safe.
Yes, and non-toxic.
Non-toxic, yes. And I've found it to be highly, highly supportive, and people are great. And yeah, it's one of the few places I'm not going to be yelled at by someone about something.
Well, that's it. I posted about Superman last night, and you know, I haven't been torn apart by it, so it's nice. It's positive.
Lovely. It's such a nice experience to be on social media and not have people explaining things to you or telling you you've done something terrible or blaming you for something, and we are people behind these screens. Be kind. I try to be as kind as I can. So,
right, and I'll make sure to stick a link for all of that in the show notes as well. But again, thecurb.com.au. Thank you again. We will see you on the next one.
Thank you, everyone, and have a wonderful day, night, wherever you are.